are continuing the study of the book of Romans that we began recently. This is message number 3, entitled, A Preacher in Debt. We'll be looking at Romans chapter 1, verses 8 to 15. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I make mention of you always in my prayers, making request if by any means now at length I might have a prosperous journey by the will of God to come unto you. For I long to see you, that I may impart unto you some spiritual gift to the end you may be established. That is, that I may be comforted together with you by the mutual faith both of you and me. Now I would not have you ignorant, brethren, that oftentimes I purposed to come unto you, but was let hitherto, that I might have some fruit among you also, even as among other Gentiles. I am debtor both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, both to the wise and to the unwise. So as much as in me is, I am ready to preach the gospel to you that are at Rome also. Now, the opening part of this letter runs from verse 1 through verse 15 here in chapter number 1. And we would call this whole section the introduction of the letter. And it consists of two primary parts, the salutation, verses 1 to 7, and the thanksgiving in verses 8 to 15. And those are simply just standard forms that we find in New Testament letters, but they are rather longer in the letter to Romans than they are in the others. Now, the salutation in verses 1 to 7, and that's what we looked at the last time, the salutation identifies the author and identifies the recipients of the letter and gives them a brief greeting. And so from the very start, we see that Paul introduces the unifying theme of this entire letter, which is the gospel of Jesus Christ. The gospel, he states there in this opening verses, the gospel originates with God. It was promised before in the Old Testament scriptures, that of the law and the prophets and such. The gospel promised concerns God's Son. He was born in the flesh as a descendant of David, and so David's son. He died and was raised to life through the Holy Spirit to power, and hence is the Son of God. We see also in these first few verses that Jesus gives grace to Jews and to Gentiles alike. He called his apostles to witness of his resurrection and to give his words to those who believe. Paul was especially called to proclaim his name and his salvation among the Gentiles. And of course, we also see in these opening verses of the salutation that the only proper response to God's good news of his Son is, as Paul puts it in verse 5, obedience to the faith. That word indicates submitting to the gospel of Jesus Christ, who's the Son of David and who is God's Son in power. And so Paul, from the start, sets the tone for this whole letter. The importance of the gospel for bringing Jews and Gentiles to faith and also to unity in the same body. So we are looking at the second part now of this introduction, or the introductory part of this letter to the Romans, and that's verses 8 to 15. So they are the second part of this opening, and it is what is typically referred to as a thanksgiving section, and you can see how he starts in verse 8. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all. That's why it's named the thanksgiving section, where Paul expresses his thankfulness for the Roman churches. Paul also explains his travel plans with an explanation for not visiting them up to the point that he's writing this letter. He also explains that he does want to visit them and he wants to strengthen them in the faith and to preach the gospel in Rome. So we're going to look at this thanksgiving section in two parts, verses 8 to 12, which show us Paul's desire to go to Rome, and verses 13 to 15, which show us Paul's explanation for why he has not yet visited Rome. So we'll begin in the first part with verse number 8. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. Now, as you read on from here, you will notice that there's a first. Paul says, first, I thank my God through Jesus Christ. But there's no second or third or anything else that really follows. So Paul is not giving us something that's at the head of a numbered list and that you might say, first of all this, second of all that, and third of all so on. But rather, this introductory section is explaining why Paul is writing to them in the way that he is and at the time that he is. And so his use of first here is for priority. He wants to make sure, first of all, that they understand this. Before he gets into the unfolding of this letter and what he has to say to them, he wants to make sure that they know of his thankfulness for them and of his continued prayers for them before he gets on to what else he has to say. So Paul expresses here a genuine thankfulness for the faithful Christians in Rome. He says, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all. He's genuinely thankful for these faithful Christians in the ruling city of the Roman Empire. He was specifically thankful for the testimony of their faith. He says that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. The word of their belief, of their teaching, of their practice, and all of those things can be encompassed in that term that expresses that their faith was spoken of. It had gone throughout the world. No doubt this testimony concerning the Roman believers had passed throughout the various churches in the various regions throughout the world that Paul had been to. Now, we can't always assume that all the press was positive. I would say that the testimony of the Roman Christians that had gone throughout the churches was positive in a sense that it was a cause of rejoicing and thankfulness on the part of Paul. But historically, we know that the Jews were expelled from Rome in 49 AD by Claudius. And historically, it is recorded because the Jews were in a constant agitation and a constant state of disputing about someone named Crestus. And that is, of course, a Latinized form referring to Christ or to Jesus. In other words, the reason, historically, the reason stated for the Jews being expelled from Rome is that they were in a constant uproar over this Jesus Christ. Now, about 5 years later, they were indeed allowed back into Rome. And as we saw at the end of the letter, that Aquila and Priscilla are back there in Rome. And that would have happened about 3 years before Paul was writing this letter. So the Jews had been expelled from Rome because of a great uproar with the Christian gospel being preached and disputes about Jesus of Nazareth. And about 3 years prior to the writing of this letter, they had been allowed back into Rome. And no doubt this dispute that arose among the Jews was owing to the influence of the preaching among those believers there, the preaching by the church that was in Rome. We go on in verse number 9. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I make mention of you always in my prayers. Paul assures the Roman Christians of his prayers for them. And he assures them with three particulars. First of all, he calls God to witness about his prayers in Rome. And secondly, he tells them that he has not ceased. He prays without ceasing, meaning that he has not left off praying for them. It wasn't something that he did merely sporadically, and it wasn't something that he did just for a season, but it is something that he has not left off doing. And then thirdly, that he mentions them in his prayers always, or as the word indicates, continually. So they have been in the Apostle Paul's prayers for a long time, and they have been a constant presence in his prayers as he has thought of them and prayed for them. Now, Paul is also here foreshadowing a little bit his further explanation of why he has not yet been to Rome. You see, in verse 1, we talked about how that as Paul starts this letter, the very first thing that he says is, Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, the word being doulos there, indicating a slave. Paul, the slave of Jesus Christ, is how he introduces himself. That means that his will is fully submitted to the will of his master. He's not in charge of his own life, so to speak. He's not just simply making his own decisions and his own plans and just doing whatever it is that Paul wants to do. No, he's the slave. He is owned by another. He is sold entirely to Jesus Christ, to his direction. So Paul might desire, he might plan, he might even attempt to do something, but he knew that he was not in control of his own life. He was willingly yielded to God for his service. He wasn't in control. Like when he tried to preach in Asia and then tried to preach in Bithynia. And the Bible tells us in Acts 16, verses 6 and 7, that he simply wasn't permitted to do so by the Holy Spirit. It was not allowed. So what Paul says here is that he serves with his Spirit in the gospel of his Son, speaking about God, whom he has just called to witness. He has been called and commissioned to gospel service. We see that especially verse 1 and verse 5. And Paul had learned long ago that though he was committed to expand the declaration of the gospel to all the world, he was ultimately submitted to the Lord of the gospel and served according to his will. Paul, I'm sure, didn't get to all the places he wanted to go. Historically, we're not sure if he ever reached Spain. There are some that suggest that he did and others that he didn't. And that's really not something that we can settle, I believe, on this side of eternity. But I'm sure that Paul didn't get to everywhere that he wanted to go to preach the gospel. He didn't get to accomplish everything he would like to have seen done. But ultimately, he acknowledges that he serves the Lord of the gospel. And it's his will that dictates Paul's life. Verse 10. Making request, if by any means now at length I might have a prosperous journey by the will of God to come unto you. So Paul he's still talking here about his prayers for the Romans. And one particular request that Paul had prayed was to visit the brothers in Rome. Now he's acknowledging here his submission to God's will in the matter. He had prayed, he had asked if it was according to God's will that he would be permitted to come to Rome. We know that he would get to Rome. Though I'm certain that was not the way that Paul had prayed to get there, through the shipwreck and the imprisonment and the years that it took him to get there. I'm sure that was not the way Paul prayed to get there. He had prayed to get to Rome, and he did finally get there. God answered that prayer, but not exactly in the way that Paul would have thought. But overall, I believe what we get from the reading of the latter part of the book of Acts is that Paul was still yet content. He got to Rome. He had been told by the Lord that he was going to go to Rome, and he was content to be there. Again, though I'm sure he would have chosen other circumstances if he could have. So he's explaining this prayer to the Roman believers, and he has made request to God that his journey might be prospered, that he might be able, by the will of God, to come to them. In verse 11, he says, "For I long to see you, that I may impart unto you some spiritual gift, to the end you may be established." Paul further states here the reason for his desire to come to Rome. He wants to give them some spiritual gift. Now the context here through verse 13 especially gives clarity that Paul is referring to spiritual ministry among them. In other words, when he says, "I would like to impart to you some spiritual gift," that he's referring to some sort of spiritual ministry among them. In other words, it's related to the teaching and the preaching and therefore the giving of the insight into spiritual truth. Because we see that the end here is mentioned, to the end that you may be established. He wants to impart something to them that, as the word indicates, means that they will be stabilized, that they will be made firm, that they will be made fixed in the faith of Jesus Christ. It is also the same word that is used at the end of the letter in chapter 16 and verse number 25 in that same way. It's also a word that is used similarly other places in the New Testament, particularly in Paul's epistles. Just a couple of examples. 1 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 2. Paul wrote, "And sent Timotheus, our brother and minister of God and our fellow laborer in the gospel of Christ, to establish you and to comfort you concerning your faith." In the 2 Thessalonians letter, chapter 2 and verse 17, Paul wrote, "Comfort your hearts and establish you in every good word and work." So the gift that Paul wanted to impart to them was for the purpose of their being firmly fixed and stabilized, established in the truth of Jesus Christ. Now he further explains this gift in verse 12. "That is, that I may be comforted together with you by the mutual faith, both of you and me." So Paul is explaining here that his presence among them, his taking part in their ministry and in their fellowship, will mutually encourage and edify them both. In other words, Paul is going to receive from them, they're going to receive from Paul, and they're going to be comforted together. They're going to be encouraged and edified together. And that's what the word does mean. It means a joint consolation. Paul will be comforted and encouraged by his presence among them and witnessing their faith firsthand. Then we get to the second part. And it's verses 13 to 15, where Paul explains why he hasn't yet been to Rome. Verse 13. "Now, I would not have you ignorant, brethren, that oftentimes I purposed to come unto you, but was let hitherto, that I might have some fruit among you also, even as among other Gentiles." So Paul wants them to know why he hasn't yet been to Rome. I mean, he has expressed to them that he's had a great desire for a long time to go to Rome. It's been a subject of continual prayer that he might get to Rome. And perhaps he has been asked about this, why he hasn't come. Or perhaps he's anticipating the question. You know, Paul mentions how he had often meant to come to Rome, but he had been prevented. He says, "but was let hitherto." And that is an old word that means prevent. He was hindered. It didn't work out that he could come to Rome. Now, he doesn't say when he had tried to come, and he doesn't say exactly what it was that hindered or prevented him at those times. But Paul had a similar situation with the church at Corinth, actually, in which where a planned visit didn't happen, and it actually became a cause for the questioning of Paul's integrity. And he addresses that in his second letter to the Corinthians. He particularly mentions it, chapter 1, verses 15 to 18. So we don't have indication of such a problem at Rome. There's no indication there that Paul's being questioned about his integrity or whatever. And whether or not this was a question that Paul's anticipating, or maybe he just had been asked more casually, I don't know. But he is explaining further his reason why he hasn't yet visited them. Now, the reason that he desired to visit them in verse 13 is stated, "that I might have some fruit among you also, even as among other Gentiles." Now, in the next couple of verses, Paul is referring to preaching the gospel. And so immediately in this context, it appears that this fruit would be the fruit of faith. In other words, it would be people coming to faith in Jesus Christ. He's referring to the preaching of the gospel that is received and is believed, and so that hearts and lives are changed and people become committed to Jesus Christ. This is the fruit that Paul speaks of that he longs to have among them there at Rome. But also, as Paul hints at the scope of his mission, as we see even in the next verse, as he hints at the scope of his mission, he could also be planting a seed here to the tangible fruits of faith in supporting the proposed mission to Spain. Because if you look at the latter in the book, in chapter 15, verses 23 to 29, where Paul is talking about that,
He actually uses that same word for fruit there, though I think it's translated harvest. And it is contrasted with a spiritual service and a material service. It is used in that way. So it could very well be that Paul is merely planting a seed. And obviously, what we see in this introductory part of this letter are things that are going to be expanded on throughout this letter. And so that certainly could be a possibility that he's trying to plant that seed. Then we come to verse number 14. Paul explains, I am debtor both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, both to the wise and to the unwise. So Paul here refers to his debt or his obligation. Paul, as the slave of Jesus Christ, has been put under obligation to the Gentiles to preach the gospel to them. We think about his calling as explained to Ananias in Acts chapter 9 and verse 15. But the Lord said unto him, Go thy way, for he, referring to Paul, is a chosen vessel unto me to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel. And that is only amplified and reiterated throughout the book of Acts, and we see it coming to fruition in Paul's ministry. And so within Paul, we see a strong desire to go everywhere that Gentiles were and preach the gospel of Jesus Christ to them. It says, I am a debtor. I am under obligation, the slave of Jesus Christ to the Gentiles. And all of these terms that he uses, Greeks, barbarians, wise and unwise, are all terms referring to sort of the broad view of Gentiles in the world. He's just not talking about the Jews here, although we know that he preached the gospel to the Jews also, and he had great concern for them, as will come out later in the letter. Paul, I believe, was driven by the prophetic vision of converted Gentiles, where the glory and fame of God's name was spread among the nations. There's a number of places in the Old Testament where this is mentioned, where this is expressed. I want to just look at a few samples, and all these from the Psalms. Psalm 57, 5. Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all the earth. And that would encompass the inhabitants of the earth. Later in verse 9 of that same psalm, I will praise thee, O Lord, among the people. I will sing unto thee among the nations. Again, these are prophetic visions of Gentile inclusion in salvation. Psalm 67, the whole psalm. God be merciful unto us, and bless us, and cause his face to shine upon us, Selah, that thy way may be known upon the earth, thy saving health among all nations. Let the people praise thee, O God. Let all the people praise thee. O, let the nations be glad and sing for joy, for thou shalt judge the people righteously and govern the nations upon earth, Selah. Let the people praise thee, O God. Let all people praise thee. Then shall the earth yield her increase. And God, even our own God, shall bless us. God shall bless us, and all the ends of the earth shall fear him. One more prophetic vision there in Psalm 98, verses 1 to 3. O, sing unto the Lord a new song, for he hath done marvelous things. His right hand and his holy arm hath gotten him the victory. The Lord hath made known his salvation. His righteousness hath he openly showed in the sight of the heathen. He hath remembered his mercy and his truth toward the house of Israel. All the ends of the earth have seen the salvation of our God. And we can find this throughout the Old Testament scriptures, this prophetic vision of the earth being covered with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And Paul is driven by just that sort of a vision in extending that word to all of the Gentiles of the world that he can reach. Now, it was almost a decade before that Paul wrote this letter and wrote these very words that he was in Jerusalem. And he was in Jerusalem there for a council with the church about the salvation of the Gentiles. We covered that a while back in Acts chapter 15. And we read there about how these reports are given about the salvation that had come to the Gentiles and the pouring out of the Spirit upon the Gentiles apart from circumcision and apart from the works of the law. And James, the chief elder of the church there in Jerusalem, spoke of how that the salvation of the Gentiles that they were seeing, their reception of the gospel and the spread of the knowledge of Jesus Christ into the Gentile world, he said this is exactly in agreement. This agrees with the prophets. And then he quotes Amos chapter 9 verses 11 to 12 about just such a vision. So Paul was driven. He refers to preach to the Greeks, the barbarians, the wise and the unwise. The Greeks was a general designation for the cultured and the educated and the civilized people of the Greco-Roman world. Barbarians was used in contrast with Greeks, and it referred to the primitive and the uneducated and the uncultured and uncivilized peoples of the world. He further describes as wise and foolish. The point is that the gospel is good news for all people, and it is to be preached to all people, regardless of class, nationality, culture, blue collar, white collar, no collar, whatever description and distinction and anything you want to use to separate people into various groups, none of that matters. The gospel is good news to all people and is to be preached to all people. And so Paul concludes this way in verse 15, "So as much as in me is, I am ready to preach the gospel to you that are at Rome also." Paul then explains that as much as it lies to his part, he's ready to preach the gospel in Rome. His absence from Rome to this point has not been due to any lack of desire or even attempts. As he said earlier, oftentimes he had purposed to come to Rome. It seems that he had even attempted it, but it had not worked out. But it wasn't due to any lack of trying or any lack of desire on his part. But again, he's the slave of Jesus Christ. And his life is surrendered and submitted to him to use as he pleases and to go where he directs. So this opening concludes on this verse and ends fittingly by showing how that the gospel itself, the good news of Jesus Christ, is the first and foremost priority. So as we think about this opening section, the church or churches in Rome had a reputation and a testimony that had spread far beyond the city of Rome. So as large as the city of Rome was, and as large as the Roman Empire was, they certainly had a lot of important business to attend to in the city of Rome, more so than what a local church or churches might be preaching. But the preaching of the gospel in Rome led to such an uproar among the Jews that there was an edict of expulsion issued in 49 AD. And almost a decade after this letter, the persecution against the Christians would break out severely within Rome and throughout the empire of Rome. Obedience to the faith means preaching and living for Jesus Christ. As Paul shows, as his life demonstrates, as the very life of Jesus demonstrates, that causes friction in a world devoted to sin. We should not have a bad reputation because of being bad neighbors or having bad attitudes or being unloving or any other such thing. But also at the same time, we should not seek to avoid the offense of the gospel in order to try to find acceptance and approval of a world that is at odds with God and Jesus Christ. I realize that we are 2,000 years separated from the church at Rome and from the Apostle Paul. Paul was a specially called and commissioned apostle. And so there are aspects of his ministry that are not repeated or replicated in anyone else, much less in us today. But it's obvious from the opening of this letter, not to mention the mountain of other evidence that we have in the New Testament, that the gospel of Jesus Christ was of first importance and first priority for Paul. He was zealous and motivated by the gospel to preach it to all people. Now, that's not to say that the gospel is the only thing taught in the Bible, or that other teachings in the Bible are unimportant. Paul's going to talk about some other things, even in this very letter to the Romans. And it doesn't mean that they're not important, but it simply means that the gospel is of first importance. The truth of it is, whatever else that we may have right, if we do not have the gospel right, and the gospel is not at the center of what we do, then whatever else we're doing doesn't matter much. So whatever our station and stage of life, we should be zealous for the gospel of Jesus Christ to all people. It should be our great aim as a church of Jesus Christ. This is what we should be about. This is what we should be for. So I just leave us with this challenge. Let's pray together as a body fervently that this sort of gospel zeal would burn in all of our hearts. That we simply wake up and go to bed with a burning desire to make Jesus Christ known. Let's join in.